The Black Lives Matter movement has shaken this country from Ferguson to Oakland to right here in New York City. Begun as a movement against extrajudicial police killings, it's broadened to what some are calling a new civil rights movement. Everywhere the movement has spread, it's used the slogan, "Shut it down," a call for an end to business as usual in a system that devalues black life. Now, in the midst of this surging movement, has come a new manifesto arguing not just to shut it down, but to build a new economic system to reverse the centuries of racism that have marked this country. In their cover story for this week's Nation magazine, Michael Denzel Smith and Jesse Meyerson write, "It is vital for the defeat of racism that the Black Lives Matter movement shut down the economic engines propelling the continuous reinforcement of white supremacy. Only through the redress of Black America's economic grievances can we begin building a just society." The authors of that piece join us now to discuss their proposal, the history it seeks to rectify, and how it can be achieved. Michael Denzel Smith is a Nobler Fellow at the Nation Institute and a contributing writer at the Nation magazine. Jesse Meyerson is a writer and activist whose work has appeared in The Nation, Salon, Jacobin, In These Times, and elsewhere. Jesse and Michael, thanks for being with us this morning.
Good morning.
So I want to get into your program, but to start, Michael, can you outline for our listeners, as you do in the piece, some of the history that's led up to this moment, the history that informs your call for an economic program for the movement to eliminate racism?
Well, the economic exploitation of black people has been the foundation of American society. I think that what we're outlining in the piece is how capitalism and white supremacy are intimately linked to one another, and how capitalism has formed our understanding of racial identity and given us a caste system in which black Americans are at the bottom. I mean, capitalism requires a bottom to exploit, and white supremacy supplies that bottom in the form of a racial caste system in which black people are always at the bottom. So when we talk about like the history of slavery, but the problem that we have in that narrative, and that the Barbara and Karen Fields very much detail and outline in their book Racecraft, is that what most people understand is that, or most people have an understanding that Africans were enslaved because white people hated black skin, or they hated African people. But that's just not the case. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of whether or not it was expedient for them to enslave their fellow white citizens from Europe, which was not, because they were able to. They understood the idea of contracts, and they would enter into these indentured servitude contracts, which were not, short-term type of deals. Mm-hmm. They tried to enslave the Native Americans, but the Native Americans were just too familiar with the terrain to be able to enslave them for a long period of time. They would just leave these plantations. Mm-hmm. And so kidnapping Africans from the continent and bringing them here with no sense of contracts and their customs being different, and then having no sense of the terrain here, they were reliant on these new on their enslavers for their livelihood, and thus they become the working class, the labor force that drives the new economic engine. So whether we have this new understanding of racism as this like personal bigotry or not, at its very bottom, what we're talking about is the extraction of wealth from the bodies of African descendant people throughout our history.
And in the piece, you sort of detail what the implications of that are, sort of through slavery into the Reconstruction era and then into the 20th century, with things like redlining and restrictions on where people of color can live and owning property. And so all of that history obviously comes into play here. But I do want to make sure that we get to the 3 points of your program. So in the Nation piece, you sort of lay out this 3-point program, this economic agenda. The 3 points are what you call true full employment, government, an overhaul of the tax structure, and the creation of something called baby bonds. So I want to get to each of those in turn. First, let's talk about this idea of true full employment, what you call an involuntary unemployment rate of 0%. Jesse, how's this different from how we usually think about full employment, and what do we need to do to get there?
Well, so the last time we had what economists refer to as full employment in this country was during the Clinton years. And even at the peak of that, when the most people were employed during the Clinton boom, so-called, there was still 3.8% unemployment, right? Mm. So that's millions of people, right? This
right.
is a big country. 3.8% is not a really shabby little number.
No,
and the fact is, like, who are those people who aren't employed even at the time when we have full employment? Well, it's basically black people. The critical number here is 95%, because that is the unemployment rate currently for black teenage high school dropouts from wealth-poor families. 95% of those
right.
people are unemployed. So even in the boom times, those people never fully get employed. So the idea behind our idea of full employment, which is based on a two-pronged policy, the first is a federally funded job guarantee for anybody who's willing to work, and the second is a universal basic income paid out to everybody regardless of whether or not they work. What this does is it targets not just the usual sort of stimulus where we give companies money and hope that they hire people with it, but it goes straight, it does the grassroots bottom-up version of that, which is it hires people directly and then lets the profits flow from that rather than trying to get them hired out of profit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we hope to target the like least employable, least employed people in this country through this program.
And so the second point in the program, so that's the first point, this sort of full employment, actual full employment, universal basic income, job guarantees, the requirement of creating sort of programs where people can work. The second point is an overhaul of the tax structure, but not in the way that most people think of tax reform and in the sort of debates that go on about tax reform and the regressiveness of income taxes and that sort of thing. Instead, you propose a fundamental change in the way in which resources get taxed. Michael, what's the idea here in your tax proposal?
Oh, Jesse is certainly more versed in
that. Oh, Jesse, go ahead then, yeah.
Be my pleasure. So the idea is that if you look at currently gentrification, but lots of previous institutions of racism, like the racially segregated housing developments that came up after the Great Migration northward of blacks out of Jim Crow, redlining, which you mentioned in the lead-in, you know, lots of these ways of shifting, because everything is place, right? What schools you go to, what mm-hmm. medical resources are available to you, all that stuff depends on where you are, location. And that's about the land, really. We don't think about the land in like urban settings because it's like, you know, under concrete and stuff.
Right.
But really, like, location and controlling where people are, it is the critical thing for controlling where people are. So we have these land market speculators who are referred to sometimes as property owners, sometimes are referred to as mortgage investors, like during the mortgage crisis or the housing bubble where 53% of all black wealth was stolen. You have all of these land market speculators who are trying to get rich off extracting land value through investing and flipping properties.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means for black people who have wealth levels below whites is that they just get totally bulldozed. Their communities are destroyed. They're ghettoized into, you know, under-resourced communities. And it just means that that the land market and land market speculation is a huge way in which black folks are kept at sort of sub-white levels of income and wealth.
So your proposal is instead,
is
right.
Tax land,
yeah.
Tax the land value, tax 100% of it. Nobody should get any of it. We can remove taxes on labor and industry if we tax the land.
Hmm. So take away the traditional ways in which we levy taxes in this country, which is on workers, on companies, and actually tax the land itself.
Yeah, you can't offshore the land. But I should clarify, and I can lead into the third proposal here, that even if you do that, it still wouldn't be enough to make it so that black people can outbid white people for land, mm-hmm. right? So gentrification could still it would help with gentrification, but it wouldn't fix it. The only way to truly ensure that black people are on even footing with white people in negotiating for land is to make sure that we fix their wealth, racial wealth gap. Currently, black people own almost no American wealth,
mm-hmm.
and the top 10% of white families, I think, own half of American
right.
wealth.
Right.
So the obvious way to fix this is a reparations payments program.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael and I both support reparations, but the politics around that are prohibitive, basically, at this point. And so what we're going on is a proposal by Sandy Darity, who's at Duke, and Derek Hamilton, who's at the new school called Baby Bonds.
Right. So this is the third pillar of your economic program, this idea of baby bonds. Tell us what a baby bond is and how it relates to this question of reparations.
So the thing that's prohibitive about politics is that people are accustomed to, and Michael laid this out a little bit earlier, people are accustomed to blaming black people for their own poverty, for mm-hmm. saying that their poverty, unlike previous immigrant groups in the country who have experienced this poverty, that their poverty specifically is attributable to moral deficiencies, vagrancy, whatever. And so they don't deserve a handout. But nobody can claim that about a newborn infant. And so this program targets newborn infants. It gives every infant born to a wealth-poor family, that is, a family below median wealth position, it gives them a trust fund at birth that matures and they can get it at 18 years old. The farther below median you are, the greater the size of the trust fund, so that the lowest quartile, and this is not racially targeted. This mm-hmm. isn't targeted by racial self-identification. It's not targeted by if you can prove that you had enslaved ancestry. It's targeted just by class.
Mm-hmm.
If you are in a wealth-poor family, the farther below median you are, so if you're the lowest quartile of wealth position in the U.S. and you're an infant, you get like a $50,000 to $60,000 trust fund in this baby bonds program. And Darity and Hamilton say that this would close the racial wealth gap in about 2 to 3 generations.
Wow. So, Michael, maybe you can talk a little bit about why you thought that it was important to put forward this economic proposal at this moment, right? We're in the sort of upsurge of this new movement that is organized loosely under the umbrella of Black Lives Matter. Obviously, it started sort of against police brutality and impunity and has become a sort of systemic anti-racist movement. Why is this push for an economic program for this movement important now?
Well, an economic component has always been vital to a Black liberation strategy because that is at the core of what the experience of being Black American in this country has been. You know, it has been economic exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
It has been rampant poverty. It has been dilapidated housing, and it has been a constant struggle to see, some the fruits of one's labor. We can talk about, 1960s and civil rights movement. I mean, again, March on Washington is not March on Washington. It's March on Washington for jobs and freedom.
Mm.
Because people were constantly experienced higher levels of poverty in this country and higher levels of unemployment. And that leads to, a social decay in our neighborhoods, in our communities, that's only corrected through an economic overhaul. And it's important, particularly in this moment. I mean, the movement has stemmed from, police brutality and the deaths of unarmed Black people. But as important as it is to protect the very lives that we live, and ensure that we're just not being killed indiscriminately, we also have to look forward to see what will those lives look like when we protected them and when they are safe, relatively.
Right. Saving them for what?
What type of economic violence mm-hmm. has been done to Black communities throughout the history here, and how do we correct that as well?
So, we have just 1 minute left, and this is obviously not a question you can answer in a minute, but I wonder what you think it'll take to put this kind of program in place. Is this a revolutionary proposal? Is this something that we can start working on now, pushing for these proposals now? How do you see what it'll take to get this movement, this push, your economic program really off the ground?
Well, we're hoping some of these new young Black-led organizations will take up these ideas as part of their own platforms and as they push towards legislation in their local communities and nationally, and that they will become part of the conversation when they disrupt brunch, when they mm-hmm. take over the train systems, that this is also a rallying cry for them in the part of the Black Lives Matter umbrella.
So a really interesting piece by Michael Denzel Smith, Jesse A. Meyerson, the cover story of this week's Nation magazine, an economic program for Black Lives Matter. We thank you both so much for joining us this morning to talk about that.
Thanks so much, Kristen.